I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a nonprofit with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Change menus, change lives. Learn more at chefscollaborative.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
That was perfect, Vitor. Hello! It's Monday. It's 12:02. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are the Heritage Radio Network, a listener-supported network broadcasting over 35 food shows. If you weren't paying attention to the drop before this, and by the way, I just want to give a shout-out to my friends at Chefs Collaborative. Thanks so much for sponsoring my show, and many others, of course. I am a card-carrying member, and in fact, my guest today was also a member of Chefs Collaborative. In fact, he may have been a board member at one point. We will ask when he gets on the line. But for starters, we're going to go through the joys and sorrows of this week. I'm going to keep it short because I have so much to say, because guess who's on today? It's Tom Philpott, my favorite guest of all time. Tom is a correspondent for Mother Jones, has written extensively for all kinds of publications about agriculture. He's just literally one of my very favorite guests, and I'm so happy to welcome him back as this is his first outing for 2017. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about. But like I said, first we have a few joys and sorrows to cover, and they really are all about, mostly about Monsanto. Now, I don't really have terribly strong feelings about GMO crops. I know I've expressed that opinion. I don't think they're poisonous. I don't think they're going to kill us. What I do think is that they are a failed technology. And I also think that Monsanto et al., all of these big agri companies are, it's just a bad idea to have all your seeds sort of lodged in one basket, if you know what I mean. When only four companies basically are producing the world's food basket, then you have a problem. So that's why I don't like Monsanto. But it turns out, as you'll hear in a moment, that there is more to this story than I had originally thought. In any case, a court has tentatively, sorry about the snuffling, by the way, I have the worst cold possibly ever in my lifetime. So I will probably take a few sneezing and coughing breaks. I've done my best to take plenty of medication so that doesn't happen. But just in case, please forgive me for the grossness. Anyway, a court in California has tentatively ruled that California can require Monsanto to put a cancer warning on their Roundup products. But of course, it is a tentative ruling. And of course, Monsanto has sued California in retaliation. But it is a beginning. But then today, I was perusing the trades, as I am wont to do, and one of my favorite daily briefings is the FERN, the Food and Environmental Reporting Network. They put out something called Ag Insider, which is an aggregation of information about food, agriculture, et cetera, put together by the excellent Chuck Abbott. And there is a totally chilling article about how the EPA, that's our Environmental Protection Agency, essentially colluded with Monsanto to keep Roundup legal. Roundup, of course, is glyphosate, and it is so widely used not only in commercial farming, but even on your very own lawn. You know, like it has been marketed extensively to consumers for home use as well as for agricultural, industrial agricultural use. So that's really quite alarming. But anyway, so the point is that there is this letter that came out, it was in 2013, one of the senior toxicologists at the EPA said in a letter to the now retired deputy director of the agency, a man named Jess Rowland, it is, quote, it is essentially certain that glyphosate causes cancer, which is a direct contradiction of the EPA's 1991 ruling that it was completely safe. And moreover, And okay, so the quote was just that it causes cancer, but wait until you hear what she says after that. Moreover, the letter goes on to say the following, and again, this is a direct quote, "For once in your life, listen to me and don't play your political conniving games with the science to favor the registrants," referring to Monsanto. She wrote, "For once, do the right thing and don't make decisions based on how it affects your bonus." Okay, so this is coming out now as a consequence of a class action lawsuit being brought against the EPA, in which the plaintiffs allege that using Roundup causes non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and various other cancers, all of which has been, these rumors have been swirling. The World Health Organization actually upheld that last year. Monsanto has been fighting tooth and nail to squash that, and, you know, claiming that people are cherry picking studies and so forth. But I think at this point, the jury is no longer out on whether or not glyphosate is a safe chemical to use. And we do use it so widely. And by the way, many other countries have already banned Roundup or glyphosate. Evidently, they don't need to wait to see if it is as toxic as has been claimed. Those countries are actually on the side of their citizens rather than their corporate overlords, unlike the United States. And strangely enough, some of these countries are quite surprising. They include Colombia, El Salvador, Sri Lanka, Bermuda, and the Netherlands. Have all banned the sale of Roundup and other herbicides that contain glyphosate. Meanwhile, Argentina, Brazil, and Germany are considering bans, and France banned their use completely in home gardens. In other words, consumers cannot purchase or use glyphosate in their home gardens on their own personal vegetables that they consume, although clearly it's probably being used on other larger crops. But still, I mean, is that not so telling? I mean, it just blows my mind. Her name is Marion Crawford, by the way, in case you want to find her. Send her a letter of congratulations. I think she may too have left the EPA at this point, but it was just that just blew my mind, that letter. I couldn't believe, and it just shows that maybe Scott Pruitt is on the right track. Because if the EPA is colluding with companies like Monsanto, I'm not sure they're really doing their job, and maybe we shouldn't be paying for them. So, and then finally, in the category of if I can't see it, it doesn't actually exist, the administration, that is the Trump administration, is proposing to cut at least 17% from the operating budget of NOAA. NOAA is our National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and it is the principal scientific tool that we use that charts climate change, weather patterns, and so on. And those cuts would mostly affect research, education, and grants. Now, how's that for a piece of good news? What you don't know can't hurt you, can it? And lastly, which I didn't write this down, but I did want to say that we do have an outbreak of a highly pathogenic avian flu going on in the state of Tennessee. This could have major implications. It depends on how successful they are in containing it. A huge flock of chickens has already been killed. Tom might actually know more about this, and I'll ask him. But anyway, that is the joys and sorrows. And I want to wind that up by saying, could our situation in the United States be any more desperate at this point? I mean, we are witnessing a pompadoured Yahoo and his grotesque corporate cronies take apart this nation. In fact, because I'm sick, I'm a little weepy all the time. And I was literally brought to tears thinking about this on the subway right now, too. Anyway, in another 3 years, we won't even have to worry about whether or not voting rights are available to the rest of the population, because we will have our own dictatorship, problem solved. And with that, we will go to a commercial break, and we'll be right back with the wonderful Tom Philpott. We're going to talk all about the Secretary of Agriculture and what is going on in the new administration vis-a-vis our food supply. So stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by Chefs Collaborative, a national nonprofit network with a mission to inspire, educate, and celebrate chefs and food professionals building a better food system. Chefs Collaborative members work to make sustainable practices second nature for every chef in the United States. Chefs Collaborative was founded in 1993 by visionary chefs including Rick Bayless and Alice Waters, who acknowledge the influential role of food professionals on our food choices, our collective personal health, the vitality of cultures, and the integrity of the global environment. Chefs Collaborative believes that the greater culinary community can be a catalyst for positive change by expanding the market for good food and helping to preserve local farming and fishing communities. Change menus, change lives. Learn more about Chefs Collaborative at chefscollaborative.org.
Yeah, that's right, folks. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and this is the Heritage Radio Network. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher, by the way, if you ever want to listen to our archived programs, of which there are over 35. I highly recommend them all. But of course, mine is my favorite, naturally, so I hope you'll listen to mine more than anything else, and give us money, too. So today, we are going to be talking with one of my very favorite guests. His name is Tom Philpott. For those of you who have not heard an episode with Tom in the past, he is the food and agricultural correspondent for Mother Jones, where he writes the weekly Food for Thought blog online, and he contributes features and editorials to the bimonthly print magazine. He was also a co-founder in 2004 of Maverick Farms, a small organic vegetable farm and center for sustainable food education in Valley Crucis in North Carolina, and he serves on the advisory board there. He has also worked as a professional journalist for over 20 years and is currently based in Austin, Texas. In addition to his numerous appearances as a moderator and presenter, Tom, at various conferences and whatnot, and you should always try to find them in your area because he's just such a wonderful, knowledgeable speaker. Tom also hosts, you can listen to him a lot, actually. He hosts Mother Jones' newly, not that new, The Bite, which is a weekly podcast, which includes Tom Philpott, Kyra Butler, and Maddie Oatman. And then also he does a podcast, a biweekly podcast called The Secret Ingredient with the eminent Raj Patel and Rebecca McEnroy. And that comes through Austin's National Public Radio station, KUT, but it is also available on iTunes, and I highly, highly recommend it. So, Tom, welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for coming on today, especially with a little bit short notice.
Thanks for having me, Katie. Always a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you, my friend. It really is, and it's been such a long time since we've been able to talk. I mean, we have so much to cover here, so we're gonna get right off to the races here. So let's start. Let's just start with labor and immigration, because that was something that the Trump administration really just went out of the gate with a bang, not a whimper. And it was reported in the New York Times that the big ag concerns in California, who ponied up big for Trump's campaign, gave him a lot of money and supported his campaign, but they somehow failed to notice that he planned to deport their workforce. So I wondered, if you'd like to deconstruct what exactly is or could happen if the new and improved immigration executive order sends ag workers back to Mexico and Central America. What do you anticipate will be the fallout from that?
Oh, well, I laugh because it's not funny at all, but it's a sort of laugh or cry kind of situation.
Oh, yeah, totally.
I did a lot of reporting on Trump in the campaign and exactly what message he was sending to the ag community, and he sent a very effective one. The basic idea, he got a lot of, state ag secretaries and conservative governors from red states to be on his ag advisory committee.
Yeah.
And, that sort of, I think, helped convince, the rank and file that, he was going to make America great again for farming. And, it was counterintuitive because one of his messages was, we're going to, kick the immigrants in the teeth. The very workforce, the very labor force that the industry relies on. The way they sort of soft-pedaled it was, I think, pretty interesting. What they said was, look, your biggest problem as farmers is regulation. You're over-regulated at every step of the way. The EPA is, coming to your farm to shut it down, and we're going to get the EPA off your back. And then in terms of immigration and trade, which we can also get into, which is also really important to the big ag community, the idea was, we'll talk to him about those things. We'll convince him that, he wants to only let out criminal immigrants, and he'll leave our immigrants alone.
Yeah, the ones we exploit.
And so it was a sort of like under the table kind of message, like, don't worry about that. He understands you. He's not like these other politicians. So when you hear him thundering against immigrants, don't worry about your own workforces. And instead, listen to this message about how he is going to, you know, basically end the regulatory state. And that's really to benefit your farm. And I think that message, you know, basically took hold. And I think we can get into why it is that such a message resonated maybe more in farm country than Hillary Clinton's message. But that's basically what he did. You know, he never, he basically, like you said, he came into office promising to crack down on immigration, and he has made good on that promise so far. So that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone. But as you know, in places where, you know, farmers rely heavily on immigration, people are freaking out.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you know, what's he doing? They're very surprised that he's making good on his promise.
Well, I think that my guess is that most of these people thought when he talked about immigrants, he was talking about Muslims. He wasn't talking about their happy, you know, their happy fruit pickers, you know.
Well, yes, don't you think? Because, you know, let's not forget how he started off his campaign. He started off his campaign with a really kind of, you know, bare-knuckled xenophobic speech about Mexican immigrants. You know, they send us their rapists, they send us their killers.
That's true, I forgot.
And then he said, oh, you know, some of them might be good people. And so there was from the start of his campaign, it wasn't really just Muslims he was talking about. You know, he created this bogeyman of, you know, as he calls them, bad hombres skulking about.
Unbelievable.
So Mexican immigrants were in the crosshair from the beginning.
You're absolutely right about that. Yeah. Yeah.
So really, there's, you know, no one should be surprised. But I think people thought, oh, well, his rhetoric is just overheated in that topic and he'll chill out. Of course, in outside of farm country, there is a significant part of his support that is cheering this on, that, you know, think, oh, well, he's right about the bad hombres, and so we need to kick the immigrants in the teeth. And I think he is a bit beholden to that crowd, without which he wouldn't be in office.
Well, for sure. But let's talk about what would actually happen. I mean, what will happen if he manages to decimate the agricultural workforce that is largely comprised of Central American and Mexican immigrants? Like, what does that mean to us in terms of consumers? I mean, are we looking at crops failing, you know, lying in the field unpicked? Are we looking at, you know, restaurants struggling to find workers? I mean, to me, it's like from all the way from farm to fork, this is just a gigantic disaster in the making. So what do you think is the economic impact of this?
I think, you know, we're about to find out, but one thing that we should remember is that sort of talk of cracking down on immigration and talk of cracking down on undocumented workers coming from Mexico has been going on for a while.
Mm.
And there were major crackdowns in the 2000s. And, you know, we can look at a case study in Georgia, where they have a pretty strong fruit and vegetable farming sector.
Mm-hmm.
They in 2011, just after Sonny Perdue left office, they put into place a kind of Arizona-like package of anti-immigration laws, making it easier to, you know, pull people over and demand documentation on their citizenship status, and, you know, lock them up and send them home if they didn't have those. And, you know, what happened in Georgia was that, you know how this works. It's a very seasonal thing. And
right.
So you got a large group of Mexican workers and Central American workers in Florida in the winter. And as the weather warms up and spring hits southeast, they start moving up into the harvest in places like Georgia.
Right.
And in 2011, at the start of the growing season, like in April, they basically didn't show up. They were terrified, and fruit and vegetable growers lost something like $1 billion that year from unharvested crops. And, you know, so the kind of atmosphere that Trump is creating right now is kind of a nationalization of that, where, you know, he is, quote-unquote, unshackled ICE, which is the immigration Control and Enforcement Service, the right. sort of immigration cops.
Yeah.
He's really sort of emboldened them to start, you know, harassing people, checking documentation, and it's bringing that kind of fear nationwide. And so, you know, what I think ultimately, if this situation really does continue, I think what you see is you do see a rise in food prices, you know, directly based on higher labor costs.
Yeah.
Who knows? What the Farm Bureau says is 5 to 6% that
if, wow.
you know, if there is this sort of nasty, if this policy maintains itself and really kind of gets into place, you're looking at a 5 to 6% jump. What else I think you're going to see is a real push to more mechanization in yeah. the field. And, you know, California already has done, you know, the farm labor unions got pretty strong in the 70s, and one of the responses was to mechanize as much as possible.
Yep.
And so, you know, basically California's got a massive harvest of canned tomatoes or tomatoes for processing in general mm-hmm. that is pretty much all mechanized because, you know, it doesn't have to be pretty tomatoes because they're not right. going into the pyramid of the grocery store. They're going into a cannery. And so, you know, you've got this, you know, massive industry of tomatoes in California that are already mechanized. And I think we're going to see more investments in those kinds of technologies.
Yes.
And, you know, the other thing is that, you know, we already export a huge amount of our fruits and vegetables. I think it's half of, you know, about a quarter of vegetables. And yeah. a lot of that is because of seasonality, because we demand, you know, tomatoes in November and December. But I think we can see more imports. We can see, you know, more cropland in the United States going into suburban development
yeah.
And more, you know, importing from Mexico. And, you know, we should say that, you know, Katie and your listeners, you know, most of your listeners probably already know this, and I know you do, that farm workers in the United States work under pretty horrible conditions.
Absolutely.
The pay is very low. The living standards are very low.
No protections.
And, yeah, very little protection. And in Mexico, it's even worse.
Yeah.
In places like Sinaloa and Baja California, where they have, you know, massive industrial scale production of fruits and vegetables, it's very similar to here. They're basically migrants from places like Oaxaca. They don't mm-hmm. speak... often don't speak Spanish, so they're not speaking the sort of lingua franca, and they're completely exploited. And so I think we're going to see, you know, even more production shift down there
mm-hmm.
if this holds. Mm-hmm. Now, the other possibility is that, you know, these industries prevail on Trump to chill out on this. And we'll see, but there's been no sign of that yet.
Right, right. Well, you know, we're not fully into, I mean, because I think, you know, as you pointed out, this is a seasonal business. And as those crops start coming to fruition or, you know, come to ripeness and need those workers, I think then you're going to see a lot more pressure from the big growers,
yeah.
I would expect. But, you know,
yeah, I'm really
being,
curious to see what happens
right.
in the Southeast.
Yeah, yeah.
In the next month in places like Georgia, Alabama.
Well, I'm going to count on you to keep me up to date, Tom. You are just encyclopedic, guy. I mean, I'm so admiring of you. I couldn't possibly keep all the information in my tiny head that you are able to summon up at the drop of a hat. But anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Well, the admiration is mutual.
Oh, thank you, Tom. That's really sweet. But as you know, we were just talking about these crops being shifted back out to Mexico, Central America, and so other countries that we will start importing more than we export. And so let's talk for a second about the trade wars that Trump is trying to spin up. So
we excellent point.
Yeah, right. Nice segue there. You set me up really well for that.
let's just back up for a second. So if you're going to terrorize the workforce that this industry relies on, and you're not going to do anything to change our appetite for food and vegetables, we're still going to want our grocery stores stocked.
Yeah, we are.
And we're going to freak out if they don't. Then you are going to, you know, create this opportunity and create this need for more imported fruits and vegetables. But then if you're going to start trade wars with the very, very countries that we're going to rely on to produce them, then you're putting yourself into a bit of a box. Uh-huh. And, you know, we don't know how this NAFTA renegotiation is going to play out. We do know that ag is a very important thing on both sides. We import a whole lot of our corn to Mexico for the meat industry down there.
Right.
They are our number one supplier of fruits and vegetables.
Right.
And into a trade war, you know, they threatened to start buying corn from elsewhere, from Argentina or South Africa.
Brazil. South America is ramping up their corn and soy production, you know, as we speak. I mean, they are clear cutting forests just to plant soy. I mean, and they will gladly take over the, you know, when there's that vacuum from the United States, they will gladly take over that particular aspect of it.
And we're already seeing, as you know, corn and soy prices have been in the dirt for at least 2 years, and they are, as far as the eye can see. So that's another thing, another way that Trump is boxed in on this. So he's going to be alienating our trade partners and inspiring the rivals of the U.S. Midwest, as you just said, to plant more corn and soybeans.
Yeah.
You know, he's putting that part of farm country into a deeper hole. And so, I kind of think about all of these things as the contradictions of Trumpism.
Yes.
That he has all these very strongly held beliefs and these, you know, these positions that he holds very strongly, and he very forcefully gets them out there to his public. But when they sort of come together into a policy stew, it's horrible. It's like adding... You know, you're making something to eat, and you're putting in a bunch of vinegar and a bunch of cocoa powder and some bananas. And like it does not come together. It doesn't cohere into any kind of sensible,
recognizable dish.
Whatever your politics are.
Right, right. I know. It's just incredible. And I guess, you know, so that it was like. You're boiling it down to the fact that the man literally has no clue about the business of food and agriculture on either a national or international scale, and yet he is planning to renegotiate trade deals that, you know, somehow he thinks is going to improve the lot of our farmers and make food prices go down. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what his ultimate goal is with that. But, you know, in any case, it's clear that he doesn't have a clue. And that's very troubling.
Right. Yes.
I also wanted to say, I want to keep moving because we have so much to talk about vis-a-vis. In fact, I'm going to skip this next question about trade because I want to move on. And I'm going to skip my question about Tom Vilsack. But could you believe that he just like... jumped right. Talk about the revolving door, right? Tom Vilsack.
Know,
for those who
I
don't know,
I wrote something about it, and I have come under some fire from friends who worked in the Obama administration. I was too hard on Vilsack. That whatever you want to call it, the food justice movement or the food sovereignty movement or whatever you want to call it. Was too hard on him. He had all these constraints on him. He did the best he could. Oh, you know, Obama was best food president ever. You know, there was obviously some flaws in that. And people like me are too hard on him. And then the guy, you know, Vilsack he's not even out of office.
He didn't even wait until the end of his term.
No.
He jumped. And for people who don't know, he's now.
Week early.
Yeah, and, he's you know, now the CEO of the U.S. Of the U.S. dairy export.
I think there was a bit of protest in that. I think he was mad that Trump was so neglecting the USDA, so not paying attention to the transition of the USDA.
Right, right.
That he was like, I'm out of here. And I respect that.
Yeah, me too.
But, you know, this, we don't need to get too far into it, but this Dairy Export Council, I mean, this is just industrial, huge dairy.
Yeah.
And, you know, what it wants is no trade barriers, and it wants to be able to dump its, you know, milk protein concentrate or what, you know, these various
milk powder, essentially.
Components. Right. Yeah. It wants to be able to dump them far and wide
And beat the crap out of dairy farmers.
It just isn't a dignified role for someone like Vilsack.
Yeah, I was horribly disappointed. I really hoped that he would, start leading some kind of group that would actually, do what he said he wanted to do during his tenure as agricultural secretary, which was to raise up the sort of small and medium-sized farmers, the whole know your farmer, know your food thing, and, all the stuff that he and Merrigan worked on together in the first term, Obama term. I thought, well, it would be awesome, if this guy who, really showed leadership here. But no, unfortunately, he took the easy way, I don't know. It's just like I'm a little weepy because I'm quite sick right now. And so this is the kind of thing that actually makes tears come to my eyes. It's so disappointing. But anyway, let us move on. I know you reported about that. I really want to talk about Purdue. So we're going to go right to Sonny Perdue because we only have a half an hour left. So Sonny Perdue, for those of you who haven't really been paying attention to reading up on him, Sonny Perdue is our nominee for agricultural secretary, head of the USDA. This is a man who held a prayer rally in Atlanta during his governorship to pray for rain while there was a drought because he doesn't believe in climate change, but he does believe in the power of prayer. And he does believe in the timber industry and is all for cutting down forests. And he loves the bass fishing industry as well, or tournament, I should say, because, who doesn't need their frickin' recreation?
Right.
But otherwise, he's really not been a great friend to the farmer in Georgia. And then he had that whole scandal with the American Peanut Corporation, right? Stuart Parnell, he had basically slashed the budget for food inspection in Georgia, and then the Peanut Corporation, sent out some salmonella tainted peanut butter, and hundreds, literally it was 700 and something people got very sick. I think 9 or 10 people died. The owner of the corporation, Stuart Parnell, was sentenced to 28 years in prison, which was absolutely astonishing to me. I mean, I couldn't believe that happened, right?
Yeah, it just shows how bad it was.
Yes, it was very serious. So, anyway, and then I saw this Fortune magazine, actually, when I was reading up on him, they gave him huge props for aggressively introducing regulations about food safety. But that was, of course, after the fact that he had already destroyed the food safety system in Georgia. But how do you think he is going to be in terms of directing agencies like the FSIS and supporting the Food Safety Modernization Act? I mean, these, food safety issues are ongoing. They don't disappear just because the administration has changed. So what do you think we can look forward to in that sense? And who do you think would be likely to head up FSIS, for example?
Well, can we just back up for just one second
and
kind of chuckle about how if you read Politico every day and Politico has his reporters in D.C., the word you get is that Sonny Perdue is not getting his calls returned from the Trump administration.
Wow.
And he has not even, they have not even filed paperwork in the Senate to get him confirmed.
No, I
and
know.
There's no date.
Yeah.
And so Sonny right now is sort of floundering, and the USDA is floundering without a director.
Right.
And let's also recall that weeks and weeks, and that I was covering it, and it was just making my head spin, the lurches this way and that the Trump administration went through to decide who the USDA director was going to be.
Yes.
And basically, it was, people were telling me on the inside, people I know kind of in Washington circles were telling me, well, we think it's going to be this person, but, everything's out the window now. There's no coherent signal process where we know that it's going to be this candidate. Whereas in the past, you could tell pretty quickly, Obama has settled on Vilsack.
Right.
Or, Clinton has settled on this guy. Those signals completely broke down, and what you saw was, basically different forces in the administration wanting different things. And so there were, kind of conventional ag people. There was a big push to get a Hispanic person nominated because at that point, there had been not a single...
Sure.
He would be the first president since Reagan to... not appoint a Hispanic person in his first term of office. And so it was this completely chaotic process, and the chaos continues. They're not doing the normal thing of getting through with the background checks, presenting them to the Senate and and starting a date. So all that, let's just have a quick chuckle about that. We can get into Sonny Perdue, the guy.
It would be comical, but it's actually dangerous. And that's the thing that's so, you know, that just blows my mind about everything we've talked about here today. I mean, just from the point of view of the food and agriculture platform that you and I are interested in, I mean, never mind all the other issues that surround this presidency. But I mean, that in itself, this is literally dangerous to the United States, you know, citizen. And, you know, the fact that, you know, for instance, he doesn't even have, what did I read? I think it might have even been in Politico that he's of over 1,000 positions, he has managed to fill something like 300, and then his attitude towards that is like, well, who cares? Those positions are probably redundant anyway. It doesn't matter. I mean,
exactly.
You know, it's like, it's, you know, you hit your head with your hand. I mean, it's just, it's mind blowing what's happening here. It's the kind of thing that makes me cry. But anyway, right now, but
so back to Sonny and your question about what would Mikey do at the Food Safety and Inspection Service? Well, you know, one thing you have to understand about Sonny is that he was governor of Georgia, and Georgia is the single biggest poultry-producing state.
Right.
And you don't get two terms in Georgia without being pretty friendly with an industry.
That's right.
And so, and, you know, also he was a kind of a small-time agribusinessman himself. He made, you know, he made a small fortune as a kind of fertilizer dealer.
Yeah, fertilizer and grains or something,
He's very tightly in that business. And, you know, of course, you know, after he left the Senate, after he left the governorship, he started up a import-export, or basically an export business for agribusiness products.
Right.
And so, you know, he's an agribusiness guy.
Yeah, he's deep in the pocket there. Yeah, no question.
And so when you ask, you know, what's he going to do with the Food Safety Inspection Service? Well, he's probably going to put someone who is pretty industry-friendly. Up there. Of course, we don't even have speculation on that yet because he's not been confirmed. We're probably in a normal situation, probably be talking about this guy or that guy that had been floated, and we're not anywhere close to that.
Right, right. Although I did see something about a deputy secretary who was like deep in the hog business from North Carolina, and then I went back to look for that article and I couldn't find it because I had neglected to put it in my pocket. But I forget who that was, but that, I thought that gave a pretty clear indication of of what his priorities
and then,
are.
You know, they're also floating this guy named Charles Herbster as a possible number two, and you know, he's a whole another ball of wax. He's you know, he's from Nebraska, and he's a cattle guy. He's got a big cattle ranch, but the way he made his fortune is through a multi-level marketing business. That you know, basically markets a whole. He's, you know, the press usually says it's agrochemicals, and there is some of that, but it's also supplements, and you know, it's just kind of a classic multi-level marketing thing, where you know you sell. Where if I'm a rep of a company, then I get my five best friends to be reps too, and I make money every time they sell something.
It's like Amway.
Those things are, let's just say. Very dubious.
Yeah. Very dubious.
And, it's not certain that he's gonna put Herbster in, but you know, Herbster was his main ag advisor during the campaign. He was floated for USDA director. He was on that short list a couple times.
That's
a disaster. But, you know, I think just really briefly, I think one of the big things, speaking of poultry and the Food Safety and Inspection Service, you may remember that one of the really terrible controversies of the Obama administration, from my perspective and in terms of food policy, was they really pushed, the FSIS under Obama really pushed the plan to basically privatize the kill line, the inspection line of...
Right, the Hemp Act.
The poultry industry, and there's also one for hogs.
Right.
And as part of that, for poultry, the proposal that they really pushed was that they were going to speed up the line from 140 birds per minute to 170 birds per minute.
Right.
When the consensus in, if you talk to workers in the line, or if you talk to people that look at worker safety...
Or USDA inspectors.
It's already way too fast at 140.
Right.
And in the end, because of outcry The Obama administration went ahead and privatized the inspection line, but didn't allow for the speed up of the kill line. So it's still at 140.
Right.
But they did it in a way that is easily changed.
Right.
And so if the poultry industry decides under a President Trump and an Ag Secretary Perdue that it wants that line sped up, I can envision it happening with very little resistance.
Oh, me
so
too.
That's one major thing that I think we can see coming down the pike.
Yeah. And then the other thing that, because you wrote about Waters of the United States, and actually I didn't include that in my outline, but I do want to have a moment to talk about that before we talk about SNAP and the Farm Bill, because that's how I want to wrap this up. But the Waters of the United States regulation that that Obama put in, and you know, in the farm community, the agricultural community went nuts over this. And you pointed out that it didn't really have an impact on farmers. And so I wanted to deconstruct what that was all about, because the way I had read it was that farmers were angry because it would suggest that, you know, they were saying, well, if a ditch on my farm, you know, becomes polluted with ag runoff, then I can be subjected to all these fines and blah, blah, blah. And yet, in fact, as you pointed out in your article, that was not the case. So what was that tempest in a teapot all about?
To me, it was a really puzzling thing, because I've been hearing about this Waters of the United States for a couple of years, and I never dug into it, to my disgrace. I should have been on top of that. It came down in 2015, and it's been I noticed that it has been inflaming the farm press, inflaming the Farm Bureau for a while. It's this huge deal. It's this huge EPA overreach.
Right.
There's going to be EPA inspectors coming to your farm. And I noticed that the environmental community wasn't really talking that much about it. And when I looked into it, all that it was there was a Supreme Court case back in 2006 that forced the EPA to better define what a waters of the U.S. is, what a official water of the U.S. is under the Clean Water Act.
Right.
And so all it's doing is clarifying some gray areas in the Green Water Act, the Clean Water Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that the Clean Water Act essentially exempts agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, they're
so,
exempted
you know,
from almost
ask,
all regulations.
How is there a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico every year driven by ag runoff, but we have a Clean Water Act? And the answer to that, and I think it's a great question, and the answer to that question is because ag is basically exempt. And
that's
so
right.
When EPA was in the rulemaking process under Obama, when it was defining this, it was very carefully hewing to the Supreme Court decision and the opinion of one of the justices. I think it was Justice Kennedy. And so it comes out with this rule, and agriculture completely melts down. But when you look into it, at every step of the way, they repeat over and over again that agriculture is exempt.
So what do you think the purpose of the press was, of the farming press, because that's where you read all of this outrage from. What was their purpose in creating this bugaboo? This was a straw man. This didn't happen. This wasn't affecting their constituency.
Well,
so what was it, just to propel anti-Obama sentiment, anti-regulation sentiment? I really didn't understand that.
Yeah, so my reporting, I couldn't figure it out quite. Like, the Farm Bureau wouldn't really talk to me. They just kind of pointed me to their materials.
Mm.
And some of the people in the green, in the green groups would speculate, but off the record.
Right.
But what it seems like is that the way the rule was written, if you pretend away or imagine away the farm exemptions, then you, and also you think everything is a wetland, because really it's mostly about wetlands.
Right.
And, those are very specific areas. But if you do those two things, it can seem like a bunch of ditches in your farm are suddenly going to be declared waters of the U.S., and you might have to pull a permit with. I think in that community, they're so adverse to regulation that even having that language, despite the exemptions, made them freak out. And I think that, to me, the significance of the executive order that Trump issued last week, that he's making the EPA go through the process again to come up with a new Waters of the U.S. rule, The significance of Trump's action is that here is this guy who is cracking down the labor force, as we discussed, who is messing with foreign markets with his trade wars and his tearing up of trade deals, which is also bad for big ag.
Yep.
But he's delivered this big gift. he's going to take the EPA off of your back.
Mm-hmm.
And it is such an empty gesture because the EPA is not in his back.
Right.
And so I think that politically, you know, I think politically it whips the base of the Farm Bureau up into a frenzy.
Yeah.
It gets everyone riled up and then it lets them declare victory. So if you're a Farm Bureau person, you're a dues paying member and you got a, you know, 3,000 acre corn and soybean farm in Illinois, the Farm Bureau has just delivered you this massive victory.
Right.
And the Farm Bureau can hold it as a trophy. But the whole thing, to me, is just low comedy. It's just, you know, completely manipulated. And some people might even believe it. And I think a lot of rank-and-file farmers do believe it. They are very worried and scared. But it's complete manipulation by the Farm Bureau and the farm press is what I think.
Yes. Well, I mean, that was my takeaway from your article for sure. And, you know, I was thinking that, you know, the farmers had a beef and here was their beef. And then it turns out they're not even subject to this regulation. So what the hell?
Yes.
I mean,
yeah,
really.
It much more impacts construction.
Right. Right.
The case that triggered the whole thing was a guy wanted to dredge a wetland and build a shopping mall. And I think that kind of, you know, brilliant scheme is going to have a lot more problems than actual farming from the waters of the U.S.
Yeah. Well, let's turn our attention to the major issue, which is the fact that the Farm Bill is going to be renegotiated or rewritten for 2018, right? And assuming that Sonny Perdue is in fact approved as our new Secretary of Agriculture, he will be in charge of supplemental nutrition assistance programs, otherwise known as food stamps. And what do you think that's going to mean for low income populations? And what other kinds of changes do you think he is likely to push for?
Well, I mean, I think the key players for the Farm Bill and SNAP, I mean, some administrations come up with a draft of the Farm Bill and send it to Congress. Some don't. Like Obama didn't.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't do that. He kind of reacted to the legislation that was coming down the pike. And, you know, who knows what Trump is going to do. But I think the key players to look at in this fight are your Paul Ryans and your Mitch McConnells.
Right.
People in Congress. And we know that Paul Ryan has been itching to cut SNAP.
Yep.
Forever. And there's all sorts of nasty things you can do with it that don't involve cuts. Like there's programs where if a school has a certain percentage of people on the free lunch program, then they'll make it universal in that school to take the stigma out of it,
right,
just to make it easier, to make it less bureaucratic. You know, if 80% of people are getting it or whatever the number is, it's something like that.
Yeah.
Then you just make it universal. And it's proven to be very effective. It's cost effective.
For sure.
More people eat lunch. Nutrition gets better.
Yeah.
And the Republicans were really trying to kill that in the last one, but I just went off on a tangent of school lunches instead of SNAP.
But that's okay.
I should have included school lunch in the question.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. It's a different program, but it's a similar mentality.
Yes.
The same people lined up against it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you've got President Trump and Mitch McConnell leads the Senate and Paul Ryan leads the House, I think that there's potential for all sorts of mayhem to happen with policy, no doubt. The Farm Bill in general is a major black box to me because, you know, the old coalitions, the way that it worked forever and ever, and it started to break down the last couple of Farm Bills, but you had no one cared about it except for the people in Congress in urban areas who wanted a strong SNAP program, wanted a strong food assistance program, and people in rural areas with a big farming industry.
Right, who wanted the subsidies.
Yeah, they wanted their subsidies and their farm programs.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they would do is they would cut deals and say, okay, I'll vote for this if you vote for that.
Right.
And that's how we got farm bills until pretty recently. And those politics have broken down. You've got, you know, powerful right-wing forces like the Heritage Foundation, mm-hmm. which is, I think, pretty, you know, in pretty deep with Trump and also pretty tight with Paul Ryan. They want to cut farm. They want to cut not only hunger programs, but they want to cut farm programs.
Yeah.
And Paul Ryan is sympathetic to that, even though he's from a Midwestern state.
Right.
And so, you know, it's getting really hard for me to see how we get a farm bill at all. I'm sure we will somehow. But the old coalitions that used to bring them forth are breaking down.
Wow.
And, you know, meanwhile, we've got really low corn and soybean prices.
Low dairy prices.
Yeah, I mean, anything goes.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure what's going to happen.
Ooh, well, plenty of fodder for future conversations, Tom. I wanted to ask you one thing. I wanted to draw your attention to one thing. I don't know if you listened to my Joys and Sorrows segment about the EPA, about the letter. Did you see Chuck Abbott's?
I did, yes.
And that letter from, what's her name, Marianne Crawford?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, please, for once in your life, stand up for what's right.
Yeah.
That blew my freaking mind. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm starting to wonder maybe Scott Pruitt should dismantle the EPA if it's literally just a shill for, you know, or just a cover for, I don't know. I mean, I don't mean that for real, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, oh, gross.
Yeah.
Like really gross, people. Ugh.
Yeah. And you know what? That story is so interesting and it's got so many twists that I may dive into a little bit, but one thing that's interesting about the toxicologist who wrote that email was, do you know that she was dying of cancer when she wrote it?
No, I did not.
Yeah,
oh, my
she
word.
Was literally at the end, you know, at the end of a cancer bout.
Oh no.
Yeah, and so she is deceased.
Yeah. And so she had nothing to lose by writing that letter, which is why it was so blunt, undoubtedly, right?
Oh, yeah. So I don't think she was given a damn about niceties.
Yeah.
But I would like to report it out a little bit more.
Oh, I hope you will.
And just get some context for it. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a super intense situation. I think there is still an open debate about not that glyphosate, I think you're right that the debate about whether this particular substance triggers cancer, I think is closed. But I think the debate that's open that needs to be had is at what levels and at what levels are we exposed to it mm-hmm. through farming and who's exposed to it through farming. These are questions that have to be answered.
Right. Because to my knowledge,
you know, the IARC, that international body that's under the UN, their finding was that this is a carcinogen.
Yeah.
But they didn't rule on whether the way that it's used is actually causing cancer, and that's where the debate has to go. And I think that that's not a debate that agribusiness wants to have. I don't think.
No.
But it's also a debate that the green community is, you know, maybe a little bit muddying the waters on that. Because if something is a carcinogen, but I'm not being exposed to it at a level that makes it carcinogenic, then, you know, maybe it's okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I say that from a very cautious and industry critical viewpoint.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's also true that, you know, most of the herbicides in the market we know are more toxic and worse.
Absolutely. That's why organics
are
increasingly important.
I always want to say, let's, you know, instead of debating which toxic substance to put on our fields, let's think about farming practices that minimize their use.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's also a debate the industry doesn't want to have.
Well, on that note, my darling, unfortunately, I could go on and on with you, Tom, but I'm not sure listeners could stand another moment. So
I know, it's pretty.
Oh, God. But you'll come back soon,
time.
I hope. So tell people where they can learn more about Tom Philpott, and we'll wrap it up. So you have a website. I know that.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at Tom Philpott.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me on Twitter Jones. I do have a website. It's called TomPhilpott.net, I believe. And you can find me on the Bite podcast.
That's
and
right.
The secret ingredient, as Katie so generously mentioned earlier.
You betcha, homie.
Check all that out.
Check it all out, folks. You won't find a better companion for your journey to knowledge about the agricultural industry than Tom Philpott. So with that, I will say thank you so much for joining me today, Tom. And thanks again to my sponsor, Chefs Collaborative, of which I am a proud card-carrying member. And thanks, as always, to my engineer. And we'll see you next week, folks. Thanks a lot for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat and Three is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat and Three.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you save a little room for dessert.